Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Love him or hate him, Ben Bernanke's a guy you've got to pay attention to. So when he said this morning the Federal Reserve was going to start being more open with its economic prognostications, we paid attention. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Academy of Family Physicians, personal preventive care for better patient health and reduced costs for business, aafp.org/value. And by creditcards.com, an online destination for consumers to search, compare, and apply for credit cards. On the web at creditcards.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's good to have you with us on this Wednesday. Today's the 14th of November. While it might seem as if we are telling you all the time that Ben Bernanke said this or Ben Bernanke said that, the truth is the Federal Reserve only offers its official economic forecasts twice a year. Well, as of today, get ready for twice the fun. Our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon, is with us to explain. Hiya, Bob.
Hello, Kai.
You know, we hear from and about the Fed all the time, or at least it certainly seems like we do, especially these days with the credit crunch and the economy sort of teetering on whatever it's teetering on the edge of. Given all that, how significant is what he had to say today?
Well, it may seem that we hear a lot from him, but I think you and I both know that deciphering the language that these monetary policymakers use is something like trying to decipher the remains in the bottom of a teacup.
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe the best way to explain this is to compare the way the Federal Reserve has traditionally operated, and here's a clip that pretty much sums that up.
Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. The great
and powerful Wizard of Oz, yes. All right.
We're talking about an institution here that's largely preferred to operate within an aura of secrecy. The former Fed chairman, Alan Greenspan, pulled back the curtain just a little bit, but it's a lot like Dorothy here in that it's left a lot of people feeling shortchanged, especially the investors on Wall Street.
It's funny, actually, to think about Alan Greenspan having pulled back the curtain, given the opaqueness of his language. What are we going to know now with these Fed new policies?
Well, Bernanke pulled the drape cord even further back today when he delivered an address before the Cato Institute.
Improving the public's understanding of the central bank's objectives and policy strategies reduces economic and financial uncertainty and thereby allows businesses and households to make more informed decisions.
So Bernanke and his policymakers have decided that the Fed's going to issue detailed reports four times a year, and not just twice, on the outlook for the health of the economy. And they're also promising detail that's really unprecedented from the Fed. These projections are going to look even further into the future, assessing the business environment 3 years out and not just two. And they're going to be much more specific about economic growth, about unemployment, inflation, and whatever risks that they might be concerned about.
Somehow the Oz guy is just much more fun. when is this going to start?
Next Tuesday, the Fed is scheduled to release the minutes of the last meeting that the policymakers held when they lowered interest rates. Well, this next expanded set of projections is supposed to be released at that same time.
Let me get a little bit detailed on you here and ask you about something that might seem wonky, but really is kind of important. The feeling of the Federal Reserve about setting inflation targets. There's been some questions about whether or not Bernanke wants to do that. Did he?
Well, yeah, that would set a boundary, if you will, for acceptable inflation limits. Bernanke hinted that the Fed is still considering that, but he suggested that setting that target isn't going to be easy. For now, it seems that they're not going to get specific about what that limit should be.
So opening up, but only a little bit, right?
That's right.
The $64,000 question, of course, is how Wall Street is reacting. What do they have to say today?
Generally positive reviews. As we always say, Wall Street hates surprises just about more than anything else. And in the academic world, the experts are saying this can only contribute to the country's financial stability.
Bob Moon, our senior business correspondent. Thank you, Bob.
Thanks, Kai.
Tomorrow is the first key deadline in one of this country's biggest health care experiments. Everybody who lives in Massachusetts will have to have signed up for insurance. The policies have to be in effect by December 31st. Missing either deadline, tomorrow or the 31st, will trigger penalties. The plan has spread, though, beyond just Massachusetts, not necessarily to other states, but to the presidential campaigns. Marketplace's Steve Tripoli has this early report card on the Bay State's try at universal coverage.
There are 400 to 600,000 uninsured in Massachusetts. The state's new Commonwealth Connector Agency offers plans with group rates for all and subsidies for some, but only half at most of those without insurance have signed up so far. Connector spokesman Dick Powers says the imperfect enrollment numbers aren't unexpected.
This is a marathon. It's not a sprint. It took 3 years to pass health care reform in Massachusetts, and it will also take time to implement the program.
Powers says it could be 3 more years before everyone's covered, and getting there might mean tweaking the new law.
Nobody else in the country has tried this before, so I would just say simply stay tuned for changes.
The state's business community remains generally supportive. The University of Chicago's John Gable just finished surveying Massachusetts businesses about the law. He says their overall level of support has been one surprise.
And number two, to date, we show no evidence of crowd out. And by crowd out, I mean employers dropping coverage so they could get picked up on government subsidized plans.
Gable says the rest of America shouldn't think that healthier, wealthier, more educated Massachusetts is an exception. In fact, he says it's tougher here in some ways. For one thing, health insurance policies cost substantially more in Massachusetts.
And secondly, and more important, is that employees must contribute about 80% more for single coverage in Massachusetts than they do in the rest of the nation.
Gable believes what's holding things together here so far is the fact that business, unions, and everyone else took part in designing the law. It probably also helps that most players see the alternatives as less attractive. In Boston, I'm Steve Tripoli for Marketplace.
There was medical news out of Washington today, wrapped up in Medicaid policy. A Senate panel was looking into why the government is making millions of dollars in Medicaid payments to tax cheats, doctors, hospitals, and nursing homes that haven't bothered to pay their federal taxes, but who still expect Uncle Sam to pay up. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genza reports.
Senators today chewed over a new Government Accountability Office study. It concludes that 5% of Medicaid providers in 7 states owe more than $1 billion in back taxes. Some live in million-dollar houses and drive luxury cars while receiving Medicaid payments. Critics say Medicaid, which provides health care for the poor, is making deadbeat taxpayers rich.
Medicaid has become kind of a nice cash cow.
That's Leslie Page with Citizens Against Government Waste. She's not the only one who's appalled. Republican Senator Norm Coleman of Minnesota thinks he's come up with a solution. He wants to withhold government payments to anyone who owes taxes. But analysts say it's not that simple.
The states cut the checks.
That's Boston School of Public Health professor Alan Sager. He says even though the federal government reimburses states for Medicaid, the states dole out the cash to providers. The IRS says it can't be expected to keep track of that.
The states don't have easy ways of communicating their Medicaid payments to different doctors and hospitals and nursing homes to the IRS.
And there's one more problem. Medicaid officials say if the federal government puts doctors and hospitals under a microscope, they'll start to turn away Medicaid patients. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, investors follow the bouncing ball up and down and then down and up. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. $27 million are expected to fly to get where they're going this Thanksgiving. That means airplanes will be even more full than usual. And there were some interesting aviation news today that could lead to ever more crowded skies for passengers. Rumors of a merger between Delta and United. Delta CEO Richard Anderson issued a statement later this afternoon denying the whole thing. But before that denial hit the wires, we talked with Julius Maldutis about the possibility of a deal. He runs the consulting firm Aviation Dynamics.
Delta is a dominant carrier across the North Atlantic, whereas United has been extremely successful across the Pacific. So that combination will provide a very strong power to a global international system. Obviously, also, is this going to precipitate mergers among other U.S. carriers? What is Northwest going to do? What is Continental going to do? Is American Airlines going to do something? That's going to be a very interesting situation to think about.
You know, one of the things that happens when there's a big merger is consolidation, and they stop running all the flights that they would ordinarily run. I don't know if you've been on a plane lately, but the last thing it seems to me that we need is fewer flights in the air, right?
Well, the industry today is very highly competitive, and I think it's important to recognize that this combination between Delta and United would result in some cutback in flights on certain routes, but I think it would provide tremendous opportunities for the smaller companies to expand. And I think the intriguing question, obviously, is this combination going to precipitate not only consolidations and mergers among the other major carriers, but is it also going to encourage the small companies to combine?
What do you think the folks at the regulatory agencies are thinking as they read the news today?
I think they're going to be very interested. It's going to be a great Thanksgiving to think about, and there's going to be a lot of discussions over Thanksgiving.
What are the challenges to getting a deal like this done? I mean, it's no easy thing.
It's no easy thing. I think, obviously, to have the financings arranged. In my opinion, the critical piece is obviously having organized labor backing it. That's going to be the key element, because keep in mind that there was a proposed acquisition by U.S. Air of Delta, and the employees at Delta were bitterly opposed to it. And that's why that merger couldn't go forward.
How is it better for passengers if the number two and three carrier in this country get together?
Well, in terms of being direct service, improved service at both companies. So to some extent, passengers would benefit by a combination. But it really is the key issue right now, as far as passengers are concerned, is what's going to happen to fuel prices, because that's going to determine what happens to airline tickets.
That was Julius Maldutis from the consulting firm Aviation Dynamics. Investors were fooled by the timing of the rumor leak and the denials from Delta 2. United shares rose about 13% as the news hit. Delta was up about 12%. By the bell, Delta was up a much more modest 4%. United, 1.5%. New York Stock Exchange CEO John Thain has decided to jump from the rough and tumble of the trading floor to a place that's arguably rougher. Today, Merrill Lynch picked Thain to lead the way out of Merrill's self-imposed subprime troubles. His peers at other Wall Street banks have their own problems. Bank of America said today it's looking at a $3 billion write-down. Europe's biggest bank, HSBC Holdings, says the U.S. housing slump will force it to take a $3.5 billion charge. With home prices dropping, the dollar sliding, and consumer confidence way down, commentator Robert Reich says it isn't just banks that are feeling the pinch.
We may yet avoid a recession. Bernanke and company may make bigger cuts in interest rates. Congress may enact a payroll tax holiday on the first $15,000 of income, as I've urged. But look past the business cycle, and the consequences may be larger. For years now, America's middle class has lived beyond its paycheck. Middle class lifestyles have flourished, even though median wages have barely budged. The reason is we've been able to borrow so much so easily. With housing prices rising, home equity loans financed renovations and home improvements. With credit cards raining down like manna from heaven, we bought plasma TVs, new appliances, vacations. With dollars artificially high because foreigners held them, even as the nation sank deeper into debt, we could summon cheap goods and services from the rest of the world. But now the era of easy money is over. The housing bubble is bursting, and home equity is drying up. Credit card debt is next. Personal bankruptcies rose 48% in the first half of 2007, likely even more in the second half, which means a wave of credit card defaults. If you think the $1 trillion in subprime mortgage debt carried by big banks is large, think of the record $915 billion Americans hold in credit card debt. Meanwhile, as foreigners begin shifting out of dollars, we'll no longer have access to cheap foreign goods and services. For starters, you can forget that long-awaited European vacation. The splurge is over, folks. As the days of easy money come to an end, what will America look like? Maybe we'll see a recession in the short term, but more importantly, over the long term, the American middle class will have a truer understanding of what it can and cannot afford, a truer sense of what's really happened to its paychecks, and a more realistic view of where and to whom the economic gains of the last dozen years have actually gone.
Robert Reich was Secretary of Labor for President Clinton. He teaches at Berkeley now. His latest book is called Super Capitalism. Send us your thoughts about a recession or whatever else you'd care to talk about through our website. It's marketplace.org. Coming up, more consumption American style. When it comes to waste, how long can out of sight stay out of mind?
China is a huge recipient of our waste, and what's happening there is really can best be described as a cyber age nightmare.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials lost 83 points today, 0.6% to close at 13,223. The NASDAQ slid 1.1%, 29 points to end at 2644. The S&P 500 ended the day down 0.75%, 11 points, 1469 is the number. The Dow Jones Sustainability World Index pushed up more than 0.5%, 7 points to close at 1409. We're talking trash in our consumed programming today, so we tracked some waste management companies for you. They had kind of a mixed day overall. Allied Waste slid 0.8%. Waste Management Industries slopped down nearly 1%. Casella Waste ended the day up 1.5%, and Republic Services traded up 0.1%. Bonds rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note ticked back to 4.26%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. By Shriners Hospitals for Children, providing treatment for orthopedic, burn, and spinal cord injuries at no cost to the families. More at ShrinersForKids.org. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years, with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. You're listening to Consumed, a special multi-show collaboration from American Public Media. It's about the future of the consumer economy. Is it good? Is it bad? Is it sustainable? The product of a year's work by teams of reporters, you'll want to catch all of this provocative series. Coming all week on Marketplace, Marketplace Morning Report, Speaking of Faith, and Weekend America.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Thursday. Toss your soda can in the right bin for the 10th annual America Recycles Day, aimed at getting good citizens to recycle and buy recycled products. Industry folks in the paper recovery biz are in Scottsdale, Arizona for the annual Paper Stock Industries Fall Conference. And another conference gets underway in Cooperstown, New York. The agenda focuses on ways to reduce waste throughout the state. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We're back with more of Consumed, our look at the consumer economy, airing all week on this and other American public media programs. Today, guilty secrets, things we know we ought not do, like chucking all those AA batteries into the regular trash. The government is guessing it will toss 250 million computers over the next 5 years. Consumer electronics and their toxic components are the fastest-growing part of our waste stream and one of America's few booming exports. But Marketplace's Scott Tong reports some of it might be stamped return to sender.
When old computers shut down for the last time, where do they go to die? Places like this, an industrial scrapyard in the Chinese port city of Taizhou. It's a few hours down the coast from Shanghai, workers sift through six-foot-high piles of electronic trash, or e-waste. Circuit boards, monitors, keyboards, even smashed-up cell phones. Most of the stuff is Chinese waste, but I also found some imported trash from the developed world, based on the power plugs and the foreign characters on the keyboards.
China is a huge recipient of our waste, and what's happening there is really can best be described as a cyber age nightmare.
Jim Puckett is with the nonprofit Basel Action Network. It endorses an international agreement called the Basel Ban.
And it's a complete prohibition on the export of any hazardous waste from the rich countries to the poorer countries. But the United States is the only developed country, the only rich country in the world that has refused to sign this treaty.
So we Americans can still export our trash. Here's how it works. Every single hour, folks across the globe toss out 4,000 tons of e-waste, says the environmental group Greenpeace. Even if you're a good citizen and hand your old computer to a recycler, there's a good chance he sells it to a broker who puts it on a ship that smuggles it to Africa or the Middle East. Or China. In small poor villages like this one, workers disassemble old circuit boards in primitive ways. They bang off the valuable parts, for instance, computer chips with gold inside. Most of the workers are migrants, like this woman who looks over 60. We ask if the work is painful.
It hurts. How could it not hurt? But I have to do this for a living.
Another disassembler, named Chen, dips electronics in chemicals. Then he dumps the old chemical stew, which includes heavy metals like lead, into the soil.
We encounter these chemicals every day, right? No big deal.
In fact, lead is known to disrupt brain development in kids. Although lead isn't thrown away, some of it gets salvaged and formed into bricks. Then it's resold to battery makers and to metal workers looking for a cheap substitute to more durable metals. Much of it ends up in places like this, the city of Yiwu. It's one of the world's largest wholesale markets, the source of stuff at the dollar stores around the globe. Among the items for sale, low-end metal jewelry. Manufacturers here buy their metal from suppliers like Ms. Xu. She's unloading bricks of lead alloy to make bracelets and necklaces.
It could be a little harmful, I guess, but we give the customers whatever they want. If they don't want it, we don't give it to them.
American customers don't necessarily want lead jewelry, but, says attorney Steve Dickinson, they do want cheap products. And lead is a cut-rate raw material at a time of sky-high metals prices.
The United States has had an unfortunate, I think, cycle in the past 10 years of an excessive concern with price. And when price gets pushed down as far as it's been pushed, people should assume that there's going to be a problem.
Sure enough, American authorities recalled tens of thousands of kids' jewelry sets and charms this past summer. Just like toys recalled about the same time, they contained illegally high levels of lead. Here's the twist. In a provocative new study, professors at Ashland University in Ohio found highly leaded trinkets sold in the U.S. bore the chemical fingerprints of lead from old computers. Jim Puckett's Basel Action Network helped coordinate the study. He says what comes around goes around.
This very waste that we're sending to China comes back and poisons our own.
It's impossible to know for sure if the recycled lead came from America or, say, Japan or China. But Puckett's main point is that hazardous e-trash changes hands in the global economy far too easily into a shadowy supply chain of smugglers, wholesalers, and backyard operators.
This type of trade needs to be controlled. It's akin to drugs. It's akin to arms and slavery, etc. It is not a good that we're trading here. It is a bad.
In Zhejiang Province, eastern China, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
If you want to know how to properly recycle your e-waste and hear more of Consumed, go to our website. It's marketplace.org. The upsides to the consumer economy are pretty easy to see. Just take a look around at the luxuries most people in this country enjoy. But you don't have to go all the way to China to see the social downsides, says commentator Ajora Carter.
I lead a group dedicated to the idea that no community should be saddled with more environmental burdens and fewer benefits than others. Unfortunately, it's an uphill struggle. Race and class tell you where you'll find life's good stuff, like parks and trees, and the bad stuff, like power plants and waste facilities. Take the community where I live and work, the South Bronx. It's a poor Latino and Black New York City neighborhood, and it handles nearly 40% of the entire city's commercial waste. It also hosts a sewage treatment plant, a sewage sludge pelletizing plant, and four power plants. The world's largest food distribution center is here, too. It's a multi-billion-dollar industry, but most of the good stuff is trucked in and out en route to wealthier areas. That business, along with all the other industries I mentioned, brings 60,000 diesel trucks to the South Bronx each week. They're a big reason why one out of four South Bronx children has asthma. And why would someone living in a toxic neighborhood want to leave their home for a brisk walk? Our 27% obesity rate is high, even for this country, and diabetes comes with it. But the problems don't stop there. A recent study from Columbia University shows that proximity to fossil fuel exhaust from sources like power plants and trucking causes brain damage in children. Statistically speaking, poor kids who do badly in school have a better chance at prison than higher education. From my vantage point, poor neighborhoods are regional sacrifice zones created to support America's hyperconsumption. But ultimately, these impacts come everyone's way in the form of global warming and, more odiously, the cost of imprisoning our young Black and Latino men and women and their untapped potential. It doesn't have to be this way. We could spend a fraction of those dollars training people for green-collar jobs that improve the environment and provide meaningful employment at the same time. This approach won't solve everything, but it's a critical step toward a sustainable economy.
Majora Carter founded and runs the nonprofit group Sustainable South Bronx.
Marketplace is supported by U.S. Trust, Bank of America Private Wealth Management, committed to understanding the values that truly matter to clients and offering a personal approach to managing their wealth. By Grant Thornton, dedicated to serving their clients worldwide with a passion for the business of accounting. On the web at grantthornton.com. And by Putnam Investments, where a diversified mix of international investments can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, since we've been talking about trash on Consumed Today, here's a fun fact. The highest point in Southwest Ohio is a place called Mount Rumkey. It's not a natural mountain. It's trash, part of the Rumkey Sanitary Landfill, about 15 miles from Cincinnati. It's more than 1,000 feet high. About 10 years ago, one whole side of the thing let go in what was one of the largest trash slides on record. Then the built-up gases caught fire. Nobody was hurt. The mountain was rebuilt. And now there are plans for expansion. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Wednesday. Today, the Dow fell 83 points, 6 tenths of 1%. The NASDAQ dropped 29 points, 1 1/10%. The S&P 500 lost 11 points. That's 3/4 of 1% there. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Nicole Mbornoni, Eric Johnson, and Aaron Scott engineered the program for us. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Coming up next time on Consumed.
We have this place where we can really have our own economy and reimagine things from the ground up.
Is there economic life outside the consumer universe? I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong.
New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.